Welcome to BrainCore, the podcast that introduces you to new psychology and neuroscience research. I'm Tolu Faramika, and I'm joined by my co-host, Christina Valkanis. So we've reached the end of another year, and we want to thank all our listeners for tuning in. We got our Spotify Wrapped for podcasters recently, and we saw that we were being listened to in 21 different countries, so that's amazing to see. And so we're ending the year with a focus on something that I think we all enjoy. We're going to be talking about music today and its connection to memory. With that, I think it's an appropriate time to introduce our guest. Christina, who are we joined by today?
Today we're joined by Dr. Andrea Halpern, who's a professor of psychology at Bucknell University. She studies memory and thinking, specifically in regards to nonverbal materials. She also has a special interest in how musicians and non-musicians remember and respond to music. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. We're glad to have you here. Can you just start off by telling us a little bit about how your journey led you to your current role?
So I always was interested in psychology after my first undergraduate course at Brandeis University. And I quickly found that I was particularly interested in cognitive psychology, or how the mind works. I mean, what are we without our minds? And I became very interested in not just because studying the content of that subject was fascinating, but the geek part of me became fascinated in how we can externalize and study in a scientific manner something that's so intrinsically internal. I found that a very interesting challenge, a very fun one to try to solve. So I had the interest in also trying to devise techniques and credible paradigms to try to figure out how to make this an objectively studyable science. Plus, you know, what's more interesting than ourselves? We all are very interested in our own minds. So I became very interested in cognitive psychology. I took, of course, got a psychology major. When I was still an undergraduate, I did a summer internship at Brown University in Providence. And there I met someone who's become my lifelong friend and collaborator, Robert Satore. And together we decided to do my first sort of real independent project on how people perceive musical intervals. That hadn't really been done yet. We borrowed a speech perception paradigm. And I did two experiments for my senior thesis. I got to work with his advisor, the well-known Peter Imus, and go to then state-of-the-art Haskins Laboratories and make stimuli that I couldn't have done on our own. This was before the days of microcomputers that we could all make them on. And it came out very well. I enjoyed working with collaborators. I worked with him, and it was a successful project. And funnily enough, it was published without revision, which is the first and last time that ever happened in my career. So kind of downhill from there. But at that time, there weren't that many people looking at memory for things other than pictures and words. And so in my other life, I'm a amateur and devoted choral and chamber music singer. So I have a musical background. And Robert Satore actually has a degree in organ performance. So together, we both were interested in how we can generalize ideas about how the mind works to material that isn't easily described. Yet we do that all the time. But at that time, it was hard to figure out how people were doing that. So I came originally from both a memory and kind of perception background. And I'm not primarily someone who wants to understand music per se. I more look at music as a very useful domain in which to ask all kinds of interesting questions. So it doesn't have words. We have variable amounts of training. It can convey emotion, but also aesthetics. It has interesting acoustic features, and there are all different ways we deal with it, from newly encountered to well-known. And so it lets me frame a lot of interesting questions. I also sometimes study art for the same reasons.
That's interesting. So I know you just kind of touched on it, but in our emails as well, you clarified something for us. You said you study memory for music and not memory about music. So what differentiates the two?
I mostly study how it is that the mind takes this acoustic pattern and turns it into a short or long-lived representation. Mm-hmm. Not always successfully, though, because sometimes we don't do it well. So I kind of study the situations in which we don't do it as well, or we do it better. But I've only once done a study in which I ask people to tell me about their memories that involve music. And that's kind of a separate thing because that's more a narrative kind of memory. And that was kind of a standalone project, but it was kind of a little, you know, bit of an interesting foray into another part of the world. So I don't exclusively study memory. I study kind of processing broadly, but it's often memory, but not always. Sometimes I do study emotional reaction, or I've been doing some more audience outreach and engagement projects that involve how audiences react to music, for instance, when they hear a piece a second time on a program. And then I also, I've merged into some of the ideas of how we produce music by studying how it is that the mind organizes itself to sing accurately.
Oh, okay. That sounds cool. So our term of the episode today is auditory imagery. So what is auditory imagery for those that may not be familiar with the term?
Sure. So auditory imagery is when you can call to mind a tune and more or less play it in your head. And I can invite all your listeners to try that right now. So if you want to take a familiar song, I don't know what song would all your listeners might know, but if everyone, probably a universal song is Happy Birthday. So think about it now, don't sing it. Would you say that has a pitch? Did you begin on a note? Particular note?
Yeah.
You think you could find that note on the piano if I asked you to find it?
Yeah.
Does it go at a particular speed?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, maybe one of you could show the listener and just clap along to how fast you were doing it.
Do you want to do it, Tola?
Okay, sure.
Good.
Yeah, I don't know if that was too slow.
The fact that you even knew what I was asking suggests that you have this strong sense of this being kind of like hearing the music, but you also know you're not hearing the music. So it's the mental representation that occurs in such a way that real time passes and that you have a mental representation of the pitch. You can probably imagine a female voice singing it. Try it. Now change it to a male voice. You can do that. Now take a little moment because it's also effortful in the sense that this you had to pause and marshal your resources to do it, but then you did it. Mm-hmm. It's a very conscious kind of memory. And so these are sounds in the head. They're not exclusively to music. We can imagine, or some people use the word audiate, things like environmental sounds or voices. But it's the equivalent of visual imagery, but in the auditory domain, not to be confused with hallucinations. I want to make that very clear.
Mm-hmm.
You knew there was no one singing Happy Birthday. You were representing it in your mind, but you weren't confusing it for reality. If you were, that would be a hallucination, which is a pathological state.
Right. So my personal research interest is also memory, and specifically like visual imagery. And one thing I've been interested in is some individuals can't visually imagine things. Have you come across individuals that can't imagine audio at all?
Not personally, though I know some people have found individuals, and I've talked to a few researchers that have found individuals who have what is now coming to be called audio aphantasia or auditory aphantasia. There's visual aphantasia. So I have not come across any individuals. I think it's relatively rare, but I have talked to some researchers who have found that. But even less radically, one of my interests is simply in the more sort of typical population. We do vary in our ability to conjure up both visual and auditory images. So one of my main research goals in the past some years had been to develop, and I have and published, a scale, a questionnaire scale that you can take called the Bucknell Auditory Imagery Scale. Mm-hmm. And people self-rate how vividly they can imagine different kinds of sounds, verbal, musical, and environmental, and then how easily they can change one into another, what I call control of imagery. And I based it on a visual. It's been validated. I've used it in brain studies. And this does seem to suggest that even within sort of a typical range, we vary in our both self-rated ability to change, to imagine and change sounds, and that predicts certain other behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reliable scale that if I asked you, you know, there's no internal reliability and all that. And there's some interesting correlations of that with not only other behaviors, but also brain measures. So people who self-rate as having more vivid visual imagery, for instance, have more gray matter in their supplementary motor area.
Oh, wow.
People with less, it's a quite a significant correlation.
And I'm sure there's like a spectrum too, from person to person. For instance, if you take a musician, they might be easy. It might be easier for them to maybe imagine how it would sound on a clarinet and then switch it to a piano. Whereas somebody who doesn't know the like what each thing really sounds like might need to take some time to do that.
Yes, interestingly enough, in my studies so far, I haven't found a strong correlation between years of musical training and the vividness ratings. But I have something that's sort of in progress, interrupted by you know what, to look to see if I might find stronger correlations if I selected different types of musicians. So this is sort of in progress, but sort of not, with the idea possibly being that individuals who play fixed pitch instruments like piano, where you don't change the pitch, there might be a weaker relationship, but individuals who have to control the pitch, like brass and woodwind players, it's possible that they will have a stronger self-report of auditory imagery, but I don't have enough data yet to comment. What I do know from my line of research on how singing mechanisms is that individuals who self-report more vivid imagery do pitch match more accurately.
That's
the ultimate internal instrument is your own voice. You can't see anything. It has to be a mental process. And individuals, not only who self-report, but who actually do auditory imagery tasks better, there's a correlation with pitch, just simple pitch matching accuracy.
Yeah, that's cool. And you have such a diverse range of research topics. Like you talked about the ones that you did looking at audience reaction to music or how we produce music, the process of singing. But out of all of these different research aspects, I'm curious, do you have a favorite sort of topic that you've explored so far?
Oh, that's like, which one of your children do you love the most? I don't think I would. I mean, I have certain projects that I found particularly they were particularly intriguing or successful, or I did particularly fruitful or enjoyable team. So I'm not sure I would say that I have a favorite research topic, but I guess I would say the one that is kind of, I think I've made the most contributions to, is that auditory imagery line. I was one of the earliest people to be publishing on that when almost everything in mental imagery was visual imagery. Now a lot more people are following in that. So I feel that I've had perhaps in my small way the most contribution to that question and developing, again, techniques for how do you assess. So you may wonder how it is that I can tell that you're imagining something. Well, yeah. I can. So I can take a familiar tune. Like, do you know the Christmas tune, Silent Night?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No singing, please. It's auditory. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I can do things like ask people, is the second note of Silent Night higher, lower, or the same pitch as the first note? And you have to tell me as quickly as possible, press your button. Okay. I can then ask you about the fifth note or the sixth note. Mm-hmm. In other words, I can pull my question farther apart and time you. And if I get a consistent time relationship between how long it would be in the real tune for you to, if you will, scan, that suggests that you have kind of this internal regular temporal representation that would match what you were really doing. So that's one of the ways I've had people externalize. Like, I've introduced these techniques out there that other people have borrowed that involve timing, that we could tell how well that matches what might really be going on. I've done it with tempo. And so these are some of the interesting, I think, ways in which, I guess if I had to vote for one, the one that I think that I've made the most original contributions in, I think, in useful contributions, if I could answer it that way.
Yeah, no, that works too. What you said about the children, which child you love more, my grandmother used to say, if you cut off one finger, they would all hurt the same. So you need all of them.
Very wise, yes.
So I guess following from that question, have there been any findings that have surprised you?
Yeah, I think I've had surprise on two sides of one coin. And this was the subject of a recent talk that I gave at Durham University called
"Nice
Memory for Music, for Better or Worse." Because when I began doing very simple memory paradigms, now, usually with music, we don't ask people to recall like words. We have them recognized because we don't want people to sing. It can be inaccurate. So a typical standard music recognition task, I play you some tunes, I wait a few minutes, I pay you some more tunes, some you had just heard, some you didn't. You just say yes or no. Did you just hear it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, over and over again, I found that people are very bad at that. I think the most extreme example in a study that was primarily discussing this in older adults and dementia patients, but that's a separate topic yet again. But just looking at the young adults, the control participants, I gave them only 8 tunes. They heard them twice. They made ratings on how fast they were engaged. I waited only a few minutes and gave them 16 tunes, just 8 old, 8 new. Which ones did you just hear? And they were above chance, but not by a lot. They were the equivalent. We used a different measure. They were equivalent of about 73% correct. If these were 8 words or 8 pictures, they'd be 100% correct.
Yeah.
So I've been struck by, on the one hand, some situations in which you think, how do we ever get music in there if it's so hard to learn these new tunes? But on the other hand, I'm also kind of surprised that once you have engaged, you do have tunes in your head, they're in your long-term memory, it's surprisingly robust. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in a related project that also studied early stage Alzheimer's disease patients, we gave them some tunes to try to remember. Some were familiar, like Star Spangled Banner or Had a Little Lamb, and some were permutations of those. I mixed up the notes so they sound like real tunes. Mm-hmm. Have the same musical material, but they're fake tunes. And although nobody, including the patients, could remember the tunes very well, at the end I played all the fake tunes and the real tunes mixed up, and I asked these early stage Alzheimer's patients, just tell me which ones are real tunes. And they were almost entirely correct, just like unaffected people. They knew that that was the real tune. They had that memory, not from the short term, but from the long term. So once it's in there, it's very robust. When I ask people to, in a very recent study, just out, and this has been other people have replicated, or I've replicated others, if I ask you to think of a familiar pop tune that's been recorded by one artist, so it's only been at one pitch, and if you don't have absolute pitch, you can't name it. You can't say, oh yeah, that starts on a C sharp. I don't have absolute pitch. I can't do that. But if I have people find that note on the keyboard, they're not necessarily perfect, but on average, they're remarkably close. And these are not musicians. These are just, they have this long-term memory. I was doing a study with someone in which we studied repetitive, those earworms that sometimes come to you. So that's another kind of imagery. And this was a home study. So you wore an accelerometer. And when a tune came to your head, you would tap and the accelerometer would record the tempo. And then we looked to see whether that was consistent over different episodes. It was. And then we looked at the real recorded piece. And the vast majority were within 10% of the real tempo.
Wow.
So you can be remarkably accurate. Plus, like everything else, you have a lot of them. How many tunes do you know? So we have a very large capacity to remember, just like lots of other things. So it's two sides of one coin. It's very hard to learn, very robust once it's there. So I find that paradox one of the most interesting things out in my work.
Yeah, I think that there's some amazing like videos that just go viral of Alzheimer's patients picking up instruments and playing them, or like being brought to life when they hear a familiar tune. Do we know any reason why we hold on to these memories of music, but sometimes we might lose other things easier?
Well, that's actually a bit of a myth. Particularly early and moderate stage Alzheimer's patients generally have much better memory for deeply encoded information. Once you do the correct control conditions, music doesn't seem to be particularly preserved. So you have to do the right control conditions. So I have to be very careful in my field. There's a little bit of a meme and myth about how music is special, you know, unique and magical. Sometimes the research it's based on hasn't done the appropriate comparisons. I think it's more generally true that very well encoded information is more resistant to neurological insult, which would not surprise anybody. Reason why, though, music along with some other things might have a few advantages is, again, not because it's magical necessarily, but because it's there are multiple encodings. So if there's a tune, you have the music and the words. You may have an association to an autobiographical event. You may have an opinion, whether you like it or don't like it. You may have an emotional, reading the emotional message. So there are multiple codes that are a little bit different than maybe something like knowing the capitals of all 50 United States, because you don't have all those extra things as well. So once you look at it a little bit more analytically, other things that have all those characteristics are also probably benefit from these multiple representations.
Social media had us all fooled.
I'm afraid it's, I've had to fight against the so-called Mozart effect for most of my career.
The Mozart effect.
So two things. One thing, so Christina and I actually met in concert band, as our listeners know, but you may not know. So we both play clarinet. And I think while you were mentioning some of your maybe surprising findings, I was like, that is true that when maybe we're learning a new piece, it can take some time before we fully like encode the material. But then once we've learned it, we don't even need to be looking at the sheet music. Like, we can, you know, say the notes back to you as they are written, and maybe in the same tempo. So that was interesting to me. And then the second thing I wanted to mention was, maybe for those that may not be familiar, what do you mean by control conditions?
Okay. So in all scientific research, you need to, if you're looking at the effect of something, you need to baseline it, contrast it against something. Mm-hmm. So we, if we want to figure out whether memory for music is especially good, especially bad, we want to say, compared to what? So you also want to have, you do want to have a comparison. And I think a real object lesson in this was that one study I mentioned, in which we studied with two colleagues, studied memories for incidents in people's lives that involved music. So these are autobiographical memories that had music in them. And in our first study, we asked people to recall incidents in their lives that were quite very vivid, or kind of ordinary vividness, that involved music. And then the second one was, now just recall anything else, some vivid incident in your life, and just, you know, an ordinary incident in your life. We had people do all kinds of ratings for how emotional it was, how vivid, how in the moment, lots of standardized questionnaires that we didn't invent necessarily all of these. In our first pass, it looked like the memories involving music, whether I told you to do vivid or just ordinary, all of those seemed to be more lifelike for people than non-specific. Oh, okay, that was interesting. But then we, and to be perfectly honest, some people who stopped by our poster at a conference raised this question. They said, you know, what you haven't really controlled is that the specificity of the cue, because the contrast was music or anything you like. That's not really quite fair, is it? And we said, no, you're right. So we did part two, had my students involved in coming up with two other domains that we asked people about. And the two winners that worked really well were memories from your life involving meals or dining, or holidays and celebrations. Mm-hmm. So we did the same thing. And when we looked at all the ratings of vividness and being in the moment and emotionality, they all looked like the music ones. So it turned out it was the specificity of the cue.
Right.
So had we not done those two control conditions, non-musical but still specific, we have come to that erroneous conclusion. So I decided to name the paper, and this is one of my favorite titles of a paper that I've named. I like naming papers. And it was, is autobiographical musical memory special? Oh, not, I don't think that's what you get. Autobiographical memories for music special? Question mark. It ain't necessarily so.
Ah, yes. I think I saw that paper.
And it's an object lesson that you need to have these control conditions. And fortunately, the editor of Music Perception published it, even though music wasn't special. But it was a good object lesson.
I love papers that have creative titles. It's just
like, yeah, same.
if it can make you laugh a little bit at the beginning, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna read this one.
Yeah.
But since we're on the topic of myth busting and proving music memes wrong, one of the music stores in Canada, their motto is "Music makes you smarter." Is there evidence for this, or? Yeah. No, it's another meme. You heard it here first, folks.
Not first by any means. No, that's the Mozart effect thing. And now I will, of course, make that nuance. There is some evidence in very well-controlled studies that there are some specific benefits you get from music training, like other kinds of training. And it's not my field of specialty, so I don't want to give all the results at although some of it has been done in Canada, I can assure you. Canada is very active in the music psychology community. And so it is the case that there may be some specific benefits in some specific skills, but to actually overall increase IQ, you would not be surprised to know that there's really no evidence for that. There's very little evidence that it'll do you any harm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly the case that there are benefits for lots of different kinds of expertise training. And music is very good for certain things, but we do think, as you yourselves probably know, having gone through musical training, you have spillover effects, if you will, very likely to things like your auditory discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the more intellectual things like appreciating the structure of a piece of music, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody will be surprised to know that that's not a magic pill.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do have a project on the drawing boards looking for fun grant proposals going in which we're going to specifically, my two colleagues and I want to look at how widespread the benefits might be from specifically training in singing. And looking at little kids, young adults, but also senior citizens, because aging is one of my interests. This field, looking at this whole field in older adults, which has been somewhat understudied. So we'll see if we get some funding. And we have very specific tasks that we want to see if there's generalization to. But we're not making this whole sweeping. It improves everything.
Yeah.
Listening to your pleasant music tends to put you in a good mood, and that benefits certain tasks. Just on the face of it, which was one of the first sort of, let's look at this Mozart effect a little bit more closely. And that was actually one of the Canadian researchers.
Awesome.
Right.
Well, we'll have to stay tuned for that research from you. Oh, no pun intended with the tuned. My bad. But since you just mentioned too, like how happy songs can make you feel in a good mood. And earlier you were saying how music doesn't necessarily have to have words, but it's often considered like a language itself. And we have this sort of universal response to emotion in music. But is this something that we've acquired over time? Like, is it something we learn as we're growing up? Like, oh, this is a sad song. And most sad songs we hear are in a minor key. So we associate that? Or do you think it's something that we're kind of born with and that we experience innately?
There's probably several different answers. And here's where we could use a lot more of some research that's very difficult to do, which is cross-cultural research,
mm-hmm.
Which I have not been personally involved in, but I read some of it. And one of the things that makes this a little bit challenging is that, interestingly enough, compared to other cognitive skills, there's only very modest evidence that our nearest evolutionary cousins, the non-human primates, have anything like the apparatus to at least to begin to understand music that even the tiniest babies, human babies, have. So it's very hard to use evolutionary evidence or cross-species evidence as we can for some other things like memory and perception of signs. Well, cross-cultural and some developmental research is can be used here, looking at children as they grow. And it's probably safe to say that there's a combination. So, for instance, certain different cultures have different, obviously, musical systems. Almost all cultures have a musical system, but it differs somewhat. And that you learn your cultural conventions. So in Western music, yes, there's a convention that minor typically is perceived as sadder than major. But children don't begin picking that up until they're well into school. On average, tiny babies don't. that's a learned culture.
It would
be completely different. Like if you were in Indian culture, you wouldn't be born knowing what different the different ragas represent. You kind of have to be. You have to be acculturated.
Yeah.
However, there are candidates for more fundamental, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but there seems to be more evidence that something like tempo is shared. That is, all else being equal, which it rarely is, fast is generally associated with more positive valence and slower with more negative valence. That's a clearly more acoustic parameter rather than a culturally constructed one like a tonal scale. And so that would be a candidate for more widespread conveyance of certain emotions.
That's awesome. Thanks for that.
Yeah. So we're rounding down a bit now, but we like to draw attention to research intersections on the show. And you happen to be in one, because you even mentioned that like you were one of the first to start doing research on auditory imagery. So do you have any advice for students who may want to pursue an intersection, kind of like where you're at, where you're looking at memory, also in music sometimes? So yeah, any advice for students who would like to have like two interests intersect like that?
Well, I think like with all research questions, you want to not just do something, you don't want to do something simply because it hasn't been done. There may be a good reason it hasn't been done. I think what you want to do is identify a question that, with the two I's, interesting and important. And the interesting and important, of course, you can interpret both those in several ways. It can be interesting and important both from the science, from a real world implications, et cetera. So I think you always want to know is what's the unanswered question here and why is it worth answering? So, you know, to take an absurd, you know, absurd example, if a student might say, well, I wonder if giraffes can roller skate. that might be kind of fun, but I'm not sure what unanswered question that.
Yeah, it has.
Yes, that's right. You want both eyes, interesting and important, in my view. So I know that's kind of vague, but it always starts with justifying what the question is. So going from the top down, not from the bottom up, you don't want a technique in search of a question. You want a question in search of a technique.
Yeah, that's definitely great advice. And I think we'll use that to wrap up the episode. So everyone, make sure to look out for those two important eyes. Thank you again for joining us, Andrea. To our listeners, if you have any thoughts on this episode, please feel free to send us a message. Our email is thebraincorepodcast@gmail.com. And we're also on Instagram @thebraincorepodcast and on Twitter @thebraincorepod. Also, don't forget to fill out the subscriber form in our bio. We hope you all enjoy the holidays. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you are having a great brain day.